Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
After a break, Chasing the Sun, Chapter 24, epic, I'm at page 427, so 400 pages still go this page turner of interesting facts, and it certainly has led me down to investigate various relationships, and struggling to get my memory on the various aspects. I'm sure you look, I might even read the book again. Horrible thought to say, but it's a big thing for me to read and try and recall and remember various facts. Remembering, I suppose, Shakespeare using the anachronistic clock, the chiming of clocks and that type of stuff, and unequal hours, the fact that people used to not have clocks chime in the daytime. Italian clocks chimed to 24-hour time. The Canadian person who missed a train introduced 24-hour times. It's sort of various interesting tidbits. Asia being Sanskrit for dawn, other things like that. I really wish my memory could serve me a bit better. But I'm getting, hopefully I'm improving. Now, this is a quote by J.M.W. Turner, note appended to The Angel in Standing Sun, 1846. So I think he's the painter, I think. Light is not only glorious and sacred, it is vicarious, carnivorous, unsparing. It devours the whole world impartially without distinction. Jules Flodden, 1871 to 1947. The essential thing about Matisse's painting is not to judge it except by eye. You have to look at it if you look at a sunshine through a window. So I think this article is actually how you draw the sun. In the art of the Western world, it was a long time before painters depicted the sun with any real interest. For centuries, they illuminated the cavernous with indirect light, all objects near and far equally detailed and vivid. So without internal clues, it's hard to determine the time of day. Sunshine, in any real sense, is out of the picture. Painters explored the candle glow long before they turned to daylight. In medieval times, artists rendered landscapes as idealized backgrounds that represented a panoply of a god's abundance, filling in behind the main subjects. They generally ignored the world of clouds, storm, rain, sun, except for the freaks of nature, an earthquake, a volcanic eruption, a bolt of lightning, all which they could use to evoke the displeasure and illustrate some event from the Bible. The sun often appears in the sky, but is left hanging there as a talisman or accessory. That's interesting. In the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo's sun as a blotchy yellow ball being willed skyward by a pointing finger of omnipotence. It certainly has no majesty of its own. Between 1300 and 1650, however, the Renaissance man began to analyse the world around him. The sun gradually lost the power as a religious and astrological symbol. What light consisted of, how it operated, where effects were, all came under investigation. A similar change occurred in the world of art, as painters of the era began to take an interest in the nature for its own sake. By the mid... now there's this famous painter, Australian painter, who paints cows, and he's just a fantastic painter. I know one artist, but I read a book about him, and I thought, and then it was cow, but he's got fantastic cow painter, and deals with light. By the mixed 1600 landscape, the world being a very coinage of the era, had become to fit the subject for art. While Rembrandt, 1606 to 1669, often used the sun's rays to intensify his portraits, by 1650, artists such as Jacob van Rijsdael, 1629 to 1682, and Claude Lorraine, 1600 to 1682, have become interested in depicting sunlight itself. Rijsdael's attention to meteorological was extraordinary. His winter landscape with two windmills, for instance, shows a shaft of light radiating from the sun's pillar, created by convincing detail of ice crystals and freezing air. That's really interesting. Claude, one of the last artists to be known by his first name alone, was his Pablo Picasso, yes, was a friend of Nicolas Poussin, who had travelled in Roman Campania together sketching, whereas Poussin subordinates the landscape to the biblical and allegorical figures. Claude is the reverse. His subjects are the land, the sea, the air. Light, the key feature of the seaport pictures, derives from the sun just above the horizon, a feature he introduced into harbour scene 1634, the first time in history of art the sun is clearly illuminates the entire picture. He had so little interest in anything besides the natural world that he engaged others to paint in small figures that appeared on his canvas. He once remarked to the potential buyer that what he was selling was a landscape. His figures came as an extra. Whereas artists were beginning to depict natural phenomena with almost scientific concern to accuracy. In the early 18th century, for instance, German portraitist Alfred Korten Assam, having been commissioned by the Benedictine Abbey at Wittenberg to paint their order's founder, St. Benedict, said to be inspired by the innate his rule during the solar eclipse. That's interesting. Now I've just got to really, it all triggers memories. Benedictine's rule, what exactly was it? Persuaded eclipse, pursued eclipses all around Europe. Now, his rule set out times of praying based on the solar origins. The Benedictine eclipse. I should remember. His portraits shows the saint on a high tower, a thin ray of light emerging from an otherwise occluded sun. No other painter has gone to such lengths to get an eclipse detail right. Is that right? Now, St. Benedict and the eclipse, I wish I could remember that. There's something really important about that. Claude and Ruysdael had in common that they were much admired by an artist who, perhaps more than anyone else, was to make the sun his main subject. Yeah, that's Turner. Joseph Melliot William Turner, 1775 to 1851, John Ruskin recorded that weeks before dying, the old artist announced, "The sun is God," a remark that sums up his painting so appositely that, although perhaps apocryphal, it has been little questioned. Oh, that's a beautiful way of saying that. Our star was Turner's primary inspiration from a very early age. At the evening classes on the nature of perspective he attended from 1783 to 1789, he insisted on putting reflections on windows he drew on the architect's perspective sketch of a mansion. When the architect told him to paint the panes of plain dark grey and bars white, as was the established practice, Turner remonstrated, "But it will spoil my drawing." The Annual Register, who would later note that the young artist was always on the alert for any remarkable phenomenon of nature. He would not walk London streets without seeing effects of light and shade and composition, whether it be smoke issuing from a chimney pot or shadows upon a brick wall, and storing them as a memory for future use. I must admit, I'm also Sun-chan. So Benedictine's rule, I really want to get back into here. By early 20s, rather than producing imitations of his elders, as other young artists did, he was turning his canvases into visions of air and light. But he was still not, I just love the Turner. He's a great artist. It just brings you back into that sort of misty, polluted, we've got clear air here, but we can see further, but are we more isolated is my question. But he was still not equal of the master. In 1800, invited by pictures owners to view Claude's, by the pictures owner to view Claude's seaport with the invocation of the Queen of Sheba, he was left on his own to appreciate it. When the owner returned, breaking the spell, Turner burst into tears. "I shall never have anything like that." But then he had completed, he completed 300 watercolors and was already an extraordinary tactile artist. The fingertips were, for him, as capable of creating expression as any brush. When years later, the young man claiming to be the painter called on him, Turner commanded, "Show me your hands, they were clean." "Turn the fellow out," he snapped to the manservants. "He's no artist." He must have been rich. In 1802, he made up his first trip to continent. In a brief peace between Napoleon's war, Paris has packed, fluttering all the gay colours of the rainbow, harmonised and softened in the glow tints of the setting sun. He came home to produce a series of wonderful watercolours and oils. The Royal Academy exhibition in 1807, he showed sun rising through vapour, fishermen cleaning and selling fish. As one art historian has remarked, the first part of the title could easily have been the name of his heart, of half his work. How to put onto canvas the true nature of light and shadow. A sketchbook in 1806-8 illustrates Turner's musing. Reflection on water, though the real shallow is nearly the same from the plane of the horizon in near objects, yet the whole of the light lays behind it, frequently streaks a shade three times its height. That's interesting. Scientific research projects really get you into this art. In 1808, seeing an object floating on the River Dee, he observes, "The reflection of the white body may not had not any light or white reflection, but the contrary had reflection dark." There were many times, he realised sadly, when painting art toils after the truth in vain. It's interesting. He was after the truth. He wasn't, but it was his inability to show the truth which he gave with such power. In 1810, he bought a house in Twickenham, southwest of London. You had to mention Turner. You couldn't mention Turner. Thames a short stroll away. In Pelopa's desire to depict such an elemental force as water or air, he devoted himself to analysing sunlights and its portraits on canvas. Reading Goethe on the subject, who argued that colour was a product of both light and darkness, and yellow and red carried active and affirmative symbolic association. And that's, again, that's Goethe. I remember reading, going through all that, which is sort of strange in that Goethe, in a funny way, angled in on the antagonistic neurotransmitters that people have. Yeah, so you'll see red, say red, green, and blue. But if the green is missing, you'll see a different. You'll see purple. It's really interesting. He himself would write several essays on the nature of light, drawing on recent researches to show light is colour. Around 1817, he adopted a fresh palette, helped by a range of new pigments, particularly shades of yellow. It's beautiful. He stayed put in Britain until 1819, then began a series of forays to the continent, particularly Italy. The quality of light he encountered there changed his art. He began to paint golden visions, glorious and beautiful, as Constable put it. Around this time, his friend, the amateur painter James Skeen, contributed an emphatic article to Brewster's Edinburgh Encyclopedia, in which he wrote, "Painting can but approximate to all the niceties, combinations, and intricacies of direct and reflected light, modified by the most impeccable graduation of intensity as it recedes from the eye. Turner's scrutinizing genius seems to ensemble on the verge of some new discovery of colour." This is all before the photographic age, so everyone just wants a well-composed photograph now, which is sort of takes away the psychological aspect of light. Okay, that's the end quote. Nevertheless, all was praised. In 1826, the British press cavilled at Forum Romania and Cologne, the arrival of a packet boat. All is yellow, yellow, nothing but yellow, violently contrasted with the blue. Another reviewer said he was desperately afflicted with what may be called yellow fever. Turner cheerfully dismissed all such criticisms, chipping off her friend's wedding in yellow stockings and quoting Malvio depicted in Twelfth Night as cross-gartered and yellow-stockinged, perhaps at an unfortunate speech. "I'll revenge upon the whole pack of you by not yellow was famously his favourite colour. He rejoiced, or so he told his friends, in the nickname the Yellow Dwarf." It's interesting. Yeah, I suppose my favourite colours, various 581 helium lines, 581 angstroms. It's really interesting. I still live in an angstrom world. The Lyman Alpha, the hydrogen 21 centimeter line, that really gets to him. By autumn 1828, he was back in Rome, the inspiration for his great painting Regulus. As many of his latest works, the sun here consumes nearly all the elements, including humans. The painting refers to the grim story of the Carthaginians destroying transient Roman Regulus by keeping him for days in a darkened room, then cutting off his eyelids and turning his face to the sun. Wow! What's this Regulus? My God. As one critic commented, the star has become a lump of white standing out across... like a boss of a shield. With another noted that the painting could not be looked at from up close. One had to step well back, and even then it was greeted by a burst of sunlight. Viewers found themselves compelled to use the words such as blazing, firing, resplendent. How you could do this? How a painter can do this? I just don't understand. It's a ridiculous story. I'm going to have to really look at it. So it's... all these things I remember, it just gets stored in memory. It is stored in memory, but sort of lightly, so it's inaccessible. Okay. Canello's Cityscapes had captured a special light of Venice. Turner, in painting in his final years, caught by another quality of the luminous city, the way in which it casts its light over water. Some who saw these works were bothered and bewildered by the explosion of colours. Here is a picture that represents nothing in nature beyond egg and spinach. Mark Twain was to describe one canvas like a ginger cat having a fit in a bowl of tomatoes. But Turner, most discerningly admired Ruskin's, argued his work was distinguished by special intensity. Quote, of light in which he sheds through every hue... and which, far more than brilliant colour, the real source of their overpowering effects upon the eye. This is the sun, which they represent, were quiet. And this is the entire thing. This is why Van Gogh and Turner are so great, because it's the cycle. You're viewing into someone's perception brain. And quote begins, and subdued and gentle and manageable luminary, and never dazzled anybody under any circumstances whatsoever. A particularly glorious representation of sunlight, even by Turner's standard, in his 1839 painting, The Fighting Tamarind Tugged to Her Last Berth to be Broken Up in 1838. One of the best loved works of all time. Behind... let's have a look. There's a painting, is it? Yeah, this little tun. It's pretty amazing. It's a beautiful painting. Like this, even though it's a black and white one, I know this one. It's a Marty, the Fighting in a Room. Behind the old warship, a low sun fires the sky in reflection of the river. As Anthony Bailey has observed, to paint that sun, Turner packed his palette with his most ferocious pigments, lemon yellows, chrome yellows, orange, scarlets, vermilion, red, lead, hot paints that he had laid over already warm ground of earth colours. The tenement, which had served heroically at Trafalgar, offered not only an occasion for elegy but also a political point. As Turner's other main biographer, James Hamilton, describes the work, it brings the balance of facts together, sail and steam, air and water, past and present, setting sun, new moon. It balances qualities, the old age, the new dignity, the presumption of silence and noise, steadiness and urgency, temporal and eternal. It balances the geometrical forms of horizon, vertical and diagonal. Whereas these lines rush towards the setting sun, the black tug and its ghostly white charge moving inexorably out into our space. Isn't that beautifully put? Okay. It's beautiful. How could anyone write a review so good as that? Isn't that beautiful? It's got composition, time. I think, I wish I could do something like that. It's just good there. I labour to produce something over months similar to like that. Okay, there's a footnote. A letter to the Times, the 24th of August, 2005, pointed out that the camera was being towed upstream, so Turner, In sketching, so he must have been facing east as the ship was tugged west. Perhaps the painting may not portray the nostalgic sunset of the age of sail at all, but symbolised instead the dawn of exciting new age of steam. The first Timari was a French... The first Timari was a French 74-gun ship in the line captured in 1759. It was considered deadly and had the luck... and had the bad luck to rename a taken vessel, hence the presence of Schiffshore in the French sheet from which it was recaptured in 1782 in the Battle of Saints. Names were then passed on. The second Timari, launched in 1798, was twice painted by Turner, the first time showing closing with the enemy at the heart of Battle of Trafalgar. It was interesting to compare this powerful narrative with Dickens' painterly vision of the morning sun rising over the London docks in our mutual friend. The white face of the water day came sluggishly on, veiled in the frostly mist. In the shadowy ships of the river slowly charged to black substances, changed to black substances. And the sun, red blood on the eastern marshes behind the dark masks of the yards, seemed filled with the ruins of the forest it had set on fire. That's a bit rich, isn't it? Turner referred to... It's interesting that it was a captured fish. Now, that's why it's got it's a fish, a captured ship. There you go, strikes hitting there. This Timari, I'll read it to you. It's T-E acute M-E acute R-A-I-R-E. It's very French. That's my darling. And refused to sell it. As he grew older, he became even more obsessed with the sun, getting up in the early morning to watch the rise downriver of the rooftops from his rooftop balcony. The darker the day, the more craved its brightness. A friend who happened to be with him on one of those mornings saw him gazing unflinchingly at the fully risen sun. He had expressed wonder. Turner replied, "It hurts my eyes no more than it would hurt yours to look at a candle." And now his yellows were becoming white as it's white hot. He wanted to capture the pure light and seemed to understand what astronauts and space cameras have only recently confirmed, that although even the midday sun seems yellow to us, it's actually white. Once he tried, without success, to sketch an eclipse. And it's an eclipse, and I've got to remember eclipse and the Benedictine rule. I have to really get that hidden myself. Well, of course, that's bizarre, the whole thing. How we perceive yellow and as antagonistic. I'll have to go back and look at that. So it's your antagonistic perception. 12 years from painting the Timari on her essay, on her way to the breakers, Turner was reaching for his final berth. In December 1851, he is recorded as saying, "I should like to see the sun again," and it was his request that Ruskin's, not present at the time, turn into the declaratory, sun god explanation. In 1993, I asked art historian James Hamilton if he would write Turner's life. When 4 years later his book came out, one of the points he made was that given the painter's religious preoccupations, he would have said, "the son of God." We have no way of knowing. Oh, the son is God. S-O-N. Turner was far from being the only important painter. Just check on my daughter. I'm going to have to drive her. Let's see how many pages I've got left of this. Sorry for this. Oh my God. 33. We're on page 433. And this is going well up to page 446. So we've got another 13 pages of this, which is quite interesting. Turner was far from being the only important painter to take interest in the sun. Artists like Jean-Baptiste Campbell Corolla, who died in 1875, We're particularly fond of sunrise and sunset, the moments which in colour and harmoniously the symbolic potential. Sunrise, for example, tend to speak of hope, while the intensity of sunset would imply such emotions as anguish and desire. Sunset also suggested the fleetingness of the world, or perhaps the life eternal beyond death. Protagoras sometimes used it to suggest something elevated above their subjects. And so, thus, Gainsborough's Miss Sheridan shows her sunset to emphasise her contemplative side. Henry Raeburn's Sir John and Sir Lady Clerk sets them against the evening lights to impart that otherworldly glow. The culminative in this romantic culture of paintings in Europe and America in the 19th century, in contrast to Turner's vestiginous sunlight, German romantics preferred silent vistas in which luminosity pervades the vast space. Influenced by pantheistic doctrines then popular in Germany, Caspar David Friedrich, who died in 1840, and his peers sought to express the transcendental vision through the effects of sunlight as well as moonlight. The landscapes of the American luminous of the mid-19th century were also filled with atmospheric effects, capturing the wonders of the natural world, although very different mood. Although they did not articulate any particular philosophy, their paintings of vast vastness, as fast with the lights, expressed the optimism of a new country and the feeling that America was New Eden, a mighty nation, especially blessed by God. Podcast while driving. I'm just popping down to Penrith to pick up some of the car into gear, correct gear. I don't want to crash into the back of a tree behind me. Pulling out of the into our street and going down the mountain. I'm going down the mountain to pick up some brass shim. It's not actually brass shim, brass plate from a hobby shop in actual fact. And there's a little bit of a story to it. So there's two aspects to what I'm going to go through. I'm going to go through Arduino and LabVIEW and Raspberry Pi, and trying to work out which one's the best to go ahead, and trying to understand what exactly I should do. So Arduino is basically a microcontroller chip, like say a 1980s washing machine or something a bit more complex, much higher end than that. And it can basically be written by a serial bus to non-volatile memory and programmed to program on 10 digital IOs and about 8 analog interfaces. Run the power supply, that's about it. It's fairly, it's like the chip. And then the chip has a series of pin connects, and you can use these pins, which are specifically developed for breadboards and prototyping. You can use it actually in it. There's a standard 10th of an inch, 10 per inch spacing, and so you can clip onto an Arduino various shields. Now, the shields are good. You can get Ethernet or motor control shields, and ultimately it's got the shield version. I'm not quite sure whether Raspberry Pi does. So it's basically you're buying a microcontroller chip, and you can program it by a serial bus, and that's really come out more since 2005 onwards. 2007, 2010, it was modern, so it's pretty, it's pretty ready for something new. So if you're investigating it now, and basically you can serial program it, and it's got sufficient smarts about it to be actually quite useful. It's got something very useful for me, which is microsecond timing. And you think microseconds, 1 millionth of a second. You think, well, perhaps I won't need that. But in actual fact, I do, because I'm making these things which apply a pulse to make
geek pulse to a... I'm cooling myself down because I'm freezing to death with this. So, fortunately, you have to put up with me driving, some focusing, some going along. Yeah, so it's 70 millisecond pulse north, 70 millisecond south, stuff like that. And the Arduino far outperforms anything that, say, Einstein and the people in the 60s had. It switches with a shield on it, a motor driving shield. It switches very well, and even so, I'm just scratching the surface. I bought a motor shield. If you don't have a shield and you get a motor board, separate motor board, it's the same chip, motor control chip, except the chip is now mounted on a heatsink, and that allows you to access in this case, five times the power, five times the magnetic field. So I've got a factor of five for magnetic field to go up. Now, this is just with the Arduino, and I'm only going to mercifully short. I'm just trying to think how I'll do this. I'm just playing my route into Penrith. I've got to go in and get out. I differentiated because I've got this. I can now go a factor of 10, 100 times better, because the reliability of my switching as a fraction of the time is now massively increased, and the switch is instantaneous. It's something that designers could not have thought of 100 years ago when they were doing this. And so this allows me to build a much faster circuit and then start to see the response and build the response in real time, which has been a great advantage to me. So that's allowed me to walk into high Q. Now, high Q, Q is the ring down frequency. It's the loss of your resonator. So if you're a big kettle drum and you can hear it, you can hear the loss wave comes out to you. So you store, and that you store a pulse, and the loss wave goes out. Now, of course, with this, you've got a very, very tiny push. It's sort of like the opposite. The sound waves coming in and trying to oscillate it. So it's like a singing into a glass and getting it to shatter. You've got to couple it and make sure that it can actually listen to you. Now, I think I myself, having seen this, have my doubts. Now, quartz is an example of a high fidelity component. That's because it's of uniform composition and high frequency, whereas lead, if you had a lead goblet, you couldn't sing to it because it's very soft and pliable, and as it flexes, it dissipates energy. Whereas so you want something with a high spring energy. So this is what I'm doing at the moment. I'm building successively high Q resonators. And as you build a high Q resonator, your frequency has to be controlled ever more. So as I'm getting up into 300 Q, half Q is critically damped. Less than half, it's overdamped. Half, it's critically damped. It does this one across. Your cars in general, you want to be critically damped. And then this is the most important thing. Say if you've got car tires are designed to be flat and designed to have a low Q. If you overinflate them, it's not that the grip changes all that much. You increase the Q of your car tire such that it will, rather than damp, it will start to oscillate. Now, at the point when it's pushing down, it grips well, but when it lifts up, it can skid. And so if you overpump your tires, you get an excuse to skid around with us. So so with the Arduino board, I've got high frequency, so I can actually watch this. And so as I power it up, the laser line of oscillations. I've got a little laser going into my oscillator, and it thinks the you can see the line sort of grow, sort of like a flat. It sort of grows over. Obviously, I've got high Q. It goes over a couple of seconds, which is, you know, it's a reasonable growth. And but the thing with high Q, there's two things. It's the number of oscillations to half power. So if you have it oscillating 10 units, and then half power is, oh, I'm trying to work out whether it's square root of 2, 70% or, 50%, sorry, it's 50% engineering works there. Let's say half amplitude, which is slightly different from, maybe different from power. Depends how it's defined. I'm sort of used to amplitude and quantum mechanics being slightly different. Okay, so it's, let's say if it rings once to half power, that's got a Q of 4.353. Okay, and now if it rings 10 times, it's got a Q of 45.3, and if it rings 100 times, which is what's beginning to happen with me, is it gets up to 453. So I'm not 100, I'm getting a ring around 80, something like that. Now, strangely enough, counting rings over such a period of time is sort of really laborious. There's another way to get to Q, and that's your bandwidth. So you tune your frequency across, and the range, so either side of your Q for half power will be a frequency bandwidth. Your frequency bandwidth, so F divided by your frequency bandwidth is the Q of the system. So, and that's a very convenient way of doing it, because you can just program it in. Now, this is where I'm coming up a little bit unstuck, that the program in Arduino is sort of like, hang on, you can use floating point numbers, but the floating point numbers don't seem to go into the Arduino commands. Now, the Arduino commands is sort of like one step up from what you have in LabVIEW commands. LabVIEW commands, you can control everything down to the millisecond, which is more than enough for, you know, use response, you know, but for this, you have to go down to the microsecond. So there's this beautiful thing where you can say delay and write a number from 1 to 1,000. That's the number of milliseconds, or 1 to 10,000, or 100,000. It just goes up there in the delay. But if you go delay microseconds, it says delay capital case microseconds, you can program in a microsecond delay. And indeed, this is where Arduino suddenly takes off. So it's the Arduino microsecond control which allows you to go up to the high speed. Then you suddenly start to see these things. You're wanting to program it at high speed. So let's see, you've got a little board, you plug it into your computer, the little board, on top of the board is a motor controller, and you're telling the motor controller to jiggle back and forth 14 times a second. I'm just going to work out what I'm doing here. 14 times a second. So, okay. It's software controlled, whereas back in the 60s and whatever it is, they could have had. I mean, they had brilliant timing circuits in the 60s. They had the radar control and all that type of stuff. Perhaps they had it would be sort of a pretty amazing type of thing that they could really time things. They could, in the 1960s, they could time to the nanosecond. Basically, they had the counters and stuff like that. I still remember my dad's counters. They had a tube with a little ring, and the spark would go across one, And then when it gets the next one, it goes to the next, and you have these little ring sparkers, encounters, and there indeed. But it was a big feat to do something, and then convert that to a reliable current source, and you know, that's all done in solid state now. So the Arduino is pushing up there, and it does control. Now, of course, what's it shown me is that I can measure the Q of these things quite well. Now, what happens is that, depending on how I build it, these high Q things are very, very sensitive to the way that I build it. And fundamentally, you could have a high Q wire, or hookup wire is by far the best wire. So it's not hookup wire, it's called... Wire wrap, it's called. And this is actually wire from yesteryear. We used to have, back in the 80s, a little gun. The wire wrap would go in your gun, and you'd be up, and it was, you know, it's one of these things that everything would be, email pins would be up, and you put the gun over the top of it, and you press the little trigger, and it would wrap the wire around and pull up across, and then strip, and you could just go boop, boop, boop. You could wire really quickly with this gun. It's one of these things which I definitely miss, which is different from the prototyping boards we have at the moment. Sort of, ugh. So it's this beautiful piece of engineering to Gertz, but this wire is designed to be quite stiff, and it is apparently high Q, so I can use this. But you can't use anything which frequency damps anywhere, and I've sort of found that out. And of course, what I am looking for is the lowest signal possible. So the lowest signal possible means that I get there's some sort of signal, there's some sort of or something else which is pumping it higher than its lowest signal possible. I don't quite know how to describe that. So I'm, if I've got sort of parasitic effects, did I want to go through here? No, I don't. Can I get through out here? I really didn't want to do this. I am forced to do this. Oh, no, it's not so bad. No, that's excellent. So I'll be out here in no time whatsoever. So I'm going off to get a brass shim. So you need brass because it's a magnetic field. And although what I've built, so the Einstein stuff and the 1960s stuff was incredibly magnetically field sensitive. Now what I've built, the rig I've built, the important thing is it's not magnetically field sensitive. It purely picks up the spin. This is a pretty astonishing thing to see it operate at here. So let me say, the legend is that this device is not... The conventional wisdom is that this is not a lecture demonstration. And because it's not a lecture demonstration, there's a series of things I have to... Sorry, unfortunately, my brain is not that switched on. I have to find a park. I have indeed found a park. So the idea is that this something had, they've sort of, because Einstein's done it and it's done in the 60s, they've sort of haven't asked the question of, well, what does solid state do? And I myself didn't ask that question. I didn't say, oh, I'm so smart, I think solid state will do it. I just said, surely this is an important experiment to do. Why can't it be a lecture demonstration? An important point. I'm going to have to leave you here at the moment, and I'll continue podcasting when I get the stuff back. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm back again just after purchasing some brass 1mm strip. Look, and really, it's hard to say. This is really sort of the advantage of being a laboratory, which of course I'm not. You get your hands on something and you pick something up in your hands and you play with it for a while. You get the weight and the feel of it. And the beautiful thing is this is 1mm by thick by 12 millimeters by 300 millimeters long strip, and this is sort of ideal, and it moves and flexes, and the beautiful thing is it all fit in the base of my little optical rails which I've got for it. So now let's talk about the Arduino. Is it suddenly lets you switch and control things 100 times faster and with greater precision with less. It's a mechanical switch. No matter how good it is, has this period of time where there's no current flowing. Now, with the solid state switching, it's sort of nanosecond. So there's the electric field's on at the same time. Now, this is really important because the electric field is a. Watching my way through here, guys. Yeah, the field on and off. You have your piece of metal, ferrite, and stuff like that, and it's attracted from low field to high field. So what this does is, the moment that time that it's switched off, which is, you know, with the mechanical switch, you're lucky if it's a millisecond. Okay, 2 milliseconds. And so if you have a time where it's just shaking the bejesus out of it. Now, just see how I'm going to look around here. What are you doing, mate? Sorry, there's a roundabout, a dense roundabout with too many people in it. And I'm just stuck here waiting. I don't know what you're doing. Oh, it's pandemonium. Too many people. Imagine Penrith. It's not such a big place. And you know, you get traffic jams and build up. It's really poorly designed, except you can get to the hobby shop relatively easily. Yeah, so it's all. So the Arduino is solid state. It's just sort of hiding behind a serial port, and I suppose. I just don't want to write, but I will be forced to write LabVIEW to interrogate the serial port. It's just, there's no manuals for it, and it's just such a pain for it. The other aspect of it, so I can go high frequency, and obviously the way to do, if you've got low precision timing, you know, oscillation, is to build a lower Q thing. There's two aspects. You can build a low Q thing. That's the high Q is the high Q or high frequency sensitivity you have, the longer you have to wait around. Oops. This is going to be a dream run home. And that's what I want. Let's give me an idea. The electronics is sort of just miles and miles ahead. And there's something to do with me. I'm not saying I'm much better than Einstein or anything like that. It's just after 100 years where it was horse and buggy, and now it's, you know, people, the majority of people, if they want to get anywhere, they would catch. In the majority of the world, some people would have electric trains, trams, but a majority of people would have horse and buggy and that type of stuff around that time. The fact that they did anything is great then. The second aspect is the type of pendulum that you want. Now, because this is a torsion effect, you immediately go torsion the electrons a gyroscope, and you flip the electrons up and down, and so the gyroscope acts as a torsion, a one-off torsion on your beam, and you say, oh well, the torsion pendulum. Now, the beauty or the a torsion pendulum, you can build any resonator you want, and you can build a very high Q. It's just whether it's coupled to other modes of a rotation at the same, around the same frequency. So, say if you've got a pendulum on a string, There's the torsional mode. There's the sway from side to side mode in two dimensions. Then there's the actual springiness that can pop up and down. And all these modes store energy, and they can be coupled by coupling mechanisms. And so very soon, and it's not it can top and down. It can also wobble. It can oscillate around its center of mass if it's got a very thin string helping up. Normally, if you've got a big solid bar, it can't do all of this. But if it's on a thin string, it can do all these crazy things. I can think of at least 5 oscillation modes of a torsion pendulum. And the art of it is that you want to pick one and dump your energy into one and take your energy out of one, and that you don't cut the coupling of it. And this is recipe for nightmare. And of course, I began doing this down by having it a torsion pendulum where the actual weight is suspended on a taut wire. So at least it can't jump up and there's a few oscillations about it. And this has definitely picked up the problem of the mechanical switch. You see the mechanical switch just doing around a bit like a man on a noose, you know, how they fly around in a noose. And a contribution from my friend Simon Fleming saying, why don't you try this process, this material? I began to look at what the material was, where the cue was. So initially, my first one was with rubber. You know, rubber, it would have to be, rubber is shock absorber. Now that's absolute death. And why not this material? And it was a polyurethane with an extremely hard stretch. And that possibility led to a series of things where I said, oh, well, why don't we actually make this a horizontal pendulum? It's a torsional, almost a torsional pendulum. It's sort of a cross between a torsional pendulum and a conventional pendulum. So if the axis is directly on the axis, is a torsional pendulum. And as we move off a little bit, it converts slowly, sort of linearly into a conventional pendulum. Now, the great thing about a conventional pendulum is that the oscillation speed goes up from a low to a maximum. So as your axis, so you've got a cylinder on its side and you're going to make a pendulum of it such that it can, so if you've got a wire going directly through the center of your cylinder and the cylinder's horizontal, the initial frequency of oscillation will be its rotational frequency, that the just conventional torsional pendulum. As you move the wire off center up, it will slowly increase in oscillation speed as you've got a restoring force of gravity. And that will go to maximum oscillation speed when the wire is sitting on top of your cylinder. Now, I'm able to do this because I don't have cylinders. I've actually got ferrite beads. These cost nothing, about 10 cents each. They are really sort of, you're paying more for the person smiling at you in the plastic bag than the actual ferrite beads. They're that amazingly cheap, but they're beautifully well machined. Now, just getting up here, yep. You hear me? That was a courtesy thrashing of my engine. So that person traveling along didn't have to slow down to let me in. Okay, we're almost back up. So, going up to high Q. So initially, with this, I thought, oh well, I know how to make high Q stuff. I began to work out just by playing around that if if I had any source of loss in the holding of the wire to my torsion thing, if it was anything like shock absorb or strain relief or anything like that, it would low Q down. So the advantage is that this high frequency, I began to be able to start to see these things, and it began to feed back on the Q. And I tried scalpels. Okay, and now this is again scalpel. I've got on blood thinners, so holding a scalpel is just. I did cut myself once with a scalpel and took a whole day to stop bleeding. So let's be careful with that. Now, and also I've got a risk of blood infection, all this type of crap. You know, so if I cut myself, I've got to go on antibiotics and stuff. So before the dentist, I have to go on antibiotics. It's just, there's some, I feeling fantastic now, but there's the downsides are not even worth it. So, scalpels, I can do it. Fish hooks did come along. Fish hooks, there's no such thing as a non-magnetic fish hook. And fish hooks are high carbon, unbendable fish hook. So a fish hook, doesn't bend. It snaps. It's got no purpose in life in ever bending. It's got to be the same fish hook as ever. And if the fish is strong enough, it can just break the fish hook. So I found. Now again, fish hooks, it's got a downward pointing barb. You say, oh God, oh, you know, and you've got kids around, you say, oh, you could possibly file down the bar, but that would be, I think you can't, they're unbendable. Now the great thing is that they do provide a nice sharp point, and I was able to build one of these pendulums with it, but they're sort of high Q, but they also sort of bounce your pendulum, which isn't the thing, it's not mechanically secured to it, bounces around it, so it can vibrate and jump around your fish hooks a bit, and depending on what's going on, you can get different things happening to it. So just watching here. So I think so. The Arduino allows you to go to high frequency, allows you to access high Q, and allows you to modify your pendulum design away from magnetic sensitivity. And I would say now that I have achieved the goal. I'm almost there. I've achieved it. There's no point measuring. So what you can do is that you can measure the magnetic field in your loop with a very fine wire, and the increased magnetic field in your loop is due to more electrons being aligned. Your extra kick. So if you put a loop of wire in free space, you will measure, and you vary the electric field. The electric field there will measure the B for you. But if you have, if you put the bar through it, that's going to have an impulse, an increase. Now, there's no magic. You're not saving more energy of it, because this electric field then cancels the electric field outside it. So, I say electric field, I mean magnetic field. So you get a small wire, and you can just measure the population of electrons, which are flipping. You don't have to do anything about the material. You don't have to know anything. You then have to also calculate. There's the cops. The cops going there. Now I've got this thing going around here. So, I now have it there in terms of that I introduce a large magnet around the outside. Not much effect. You can get some effect. So, but the better it's built, the more intolerant it is, and then you put it on I've put it on a Lazy Susan, the entire thing in a pool chemical bucket, and then that on a lazy Susan, and I just rotate it around, and there is no sort of magic point where the Earth magnetic field is aligned such it doesn't interact with it. It looks as though it has a very small amount to do with it. Now, what's happening here is that this is so high Q that if you shake it and so this is what I'm doing here is that at the moment I've built it from stainless steel screws and a little optical thing and solder. Yeah, so solder is by far better than glue. It's solder, it's got no yield strength, it's just, you just couldn't ask for anything better than that. Okay, what's this person doing? So I'm back home, and after this, so you're halfway through, and now the thing I have to work out is Raspberry Pi or LabVIEW. Raspberry Pi allows you to do things, but LabVIEW, so it's LIFA, LabVIEW interface for Arduino, and you can buy this as a kit, but what does it do? Does it, the big question is, is it basically a manual that you can do? And so how can you get things? Thanks a lot for listening. After this, I'll get back and finish off my other podcast. Thank you. Similar schools were to be found in Britain. Samuel Palmer, 1805 to 81, was the period's most successful realiser of solar light, an artist who, while not a successor to Turner in style or early subjects, was still inspired by him. Living in Shoreham on the West Sussex coast in his 20s, he was one of the Ancients, a group that included Blake Edward Calvert, whose nighttime wanderings led locals to call them the Extrologers, a rustic version of the Astrologers. Palmer's achieved his most famous paintings before he was 30, most of them showing their subjects under moonlight, but he was fascinated by sunlight too, especially that of the fading day. Late Twilight, 1825, in which the sun has already set, but is gloaming suffuses the sky. Yellow Twilight, 1830, the Golden Valley, 1833, the landscape and twilight. Departing from such works, the Impressionists of 1860s and 90s had something quite different in mind to the depiction of light as a natural phenomenon. They had learned from scientific studies to consider white light as a composite of colours from spectrum and realising that sunlight and its reflections reached even into shadows. They banished the black from their palettes. Nor did the sun itself appear often on their canvases. Rather, the Impressionists devoted themselves to capturing the way that light changed at different times of the day during the seasons. They made a point of going outdoors on plein air to paint until then, a surprisingly rare practice back then. Artists of earlier times might sketch out a landscape in the open, but they carried out the canvases back to the studios we completed. When, in 1876, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, 1841 to 1919, which exhibited his masterpiece Le Moulin de la Galette, Montmartre, critics recognised that the effect of strong sunlight falling through the foliage on the figures was the artist's primary concern. Of all the Impressionists, Claude Monet, who died in 1840 to 26, was the most obsessively concerned about the varying qualities of sunlight. It was his impression, Sunrise, exhibited in 1874, that earned him and his circle their nickname. Little is to be seen of the sun's disk in Monet's picture of the sea searching, reaching up to Le Havre, but a good deal of its light spills across the canvas. Monet discovered that he required a whole sequence of paintings to record the nuances of light. working on each for just half an hour a day, even then finding it difficult to capture its fleeting changes, and writing in despair, quote, "The sun goes down so quickly that I can't follow it." He came to devote himself to two series of paintings, and in both, the Haystack, I remember that, and the Rouen Cathedral series, the later 27 paintings, the former 30 all made between autumn 1819 and the summer of 1891, scrutinized nearly impeccably shifts in the quality of light hour by hour from dawn to dusk throughout the seasons when, in 1879, his first wife, Camille, was dying. She spent hours sitting by her bedside until one afternoon he realized with horror that he had was preoccupied not with her health but with the changing light of her bedspread, and fled in anguish from her room. But his self-reproach was unjust. He was simply following his lifetime passion. His obituary in the Times declared a pioneer in the discovery of the colour of in shadow. He painted colour for the sake of light rather than light for the sake of colour. Light was the main subject of Paul Cézanne, 1839 to 1906, too, not the sun itself, but its effects. Quote, "I've been satisfied by my work since the day I realised that the sun cannot be portrayed," he wrote, "but must be represented by another medium, by colour." When, in 1876, he moved to the Riviera, a town of L'Esparadis, he urged his friend Camille Passario, 1830 to 1903, to join him as friends. Passario painted with a dry, hard brush, developing granulated, thickly crusted surface, which captured the refractory character of dappled sunlight as it filtered through the dense foliage. An approach that couldn't have been more different than that of the luminous, who believe in concealing their brushwork. The ways in which the sunlight was rendered really did vary hugely during these years. Quote, "The sun is so startling, it makes it look as if the objects could be lifted off in their outlines, which are cast not just in black and white, but in blue, red, brown and purple." Pissarro didn't go, but Cézanne's own love of the region, its red roof, its blue sea, its green pine, its olive and glare in the Mediterranean sun, prolonged its experience. Exploring sunlight in its many iterations, he's depicted his filtered through the leaves on waters, in shadows cast by the noonday sun and background to labourers returning home at sunset, or fishermen chatting in the shade. In an essay on painters and their relation to the sun, the art historian Valerie Fletcher argues the impressionists exhausted the possibilities of sunlight, a general reaction set in. Neo-impressionism, a tide coined in 1886 by the critic Felix Felon, were led by Georges Seurat, 1859 to 1891, whose fascination with the principles of optics and longing to depict sunlight more accurately led him to experiment with a complex mix of colours. Seurat had first worked only on drawings without using colour at all, deliberately leaving patches of paper unmarked. The values would have alternated between light and dark, resulting in a glow or halo around the figure, an effect called irradiation. But his fullest explorations of light came through the radical use of colour, believing that his predecessors, while looking at a colossal sunrise, mountain sunset, had lost the fact that colour is merely in the brain's interpretation of variables, wavelengths. He determined to make a painting more objective by taking it back indoors. Thus, in his great work, Sunday Afternoon on the Island of La Grande Chaudette, which he painted entirely in this studio, he simulated the vivid mid-afternoon sunlight by meticulously scattering tiny dots of high-keyed solar orange among the other colours to induce a shimmering sensation, with more orange in the sunlit areas and fewer in the shade. Constable had done something similar with small points of red, but as subliminal focus, not to emphasise sunlight. His purpose was not immediately understood, and when The Models was exhibited in 1868, one critic wrote of Seurat's figures,
daubed in all colours of the rainbow, suffering, it would seem, from a horrible skin disease. Now, who's the person who did... Oh, yes, that was Turner, did lots of yellow hues. Dedicating himself to the transition of light into scientifically determined combinations of pure colour, Surratt, still only 31 when he died, would wander the poorer districts on the outskirts of Paris at dawn dusk. He called the paintings that he produced chromoluminism, to emphasise his commitment to catching the sun's colour. By treating his subjects analytically, however, he removed himself from the immediacy of the experience. A close contemporary of his, Vincent van Gogh, 1853-90, would take a very different approach. His paintings of the sun, his central subject, exploding with the intensity of his inner life. Although early on he was, like Surratt, enthusiastic about grey, or rather the absence of colour. In February 1888, Van Gogh left the native Holland, aged 34, for southern France in search of a stronger sun. Thereafter, it is a constant in both his pictures and his letters. The fact is, he wrote, "The sun has never penetrated us people of the north. Nature and the fine weather are the advantages of the south. The difference in the stronger light and the blue sky teaches you to see, and especially or even only when you see it for a long time." While living in his little sunlit house in Arles, whose outer walls he painted sunflower yellow, he painted a series of golden sunflowers as if through them he could get the sun's life-giving powers into his home. The flowers were a vehicle for the sun's energy, as were the cornfields, as sometimes thought. His description of these paintings, quote, "Under the blue sky, the orange, yellow, red splashes of flowers take on an amazing brilliance. And in the limpid air, there's something or other happier, more lovely than the north. It vibrates," he adds. Quote, "In Ferney, in Janine's, the holly back being to Quast, two painters' contemporaries, but the sunflower is mine." One of Van Gogh's tenets was that the artist should exaggerate the essential. According, his drawing suggests the sun's heat and the light by concentric circles and dashed lines. Similar visual shorthands bring to life his painted suns, in which his works The Wheatfield and the Reaper in 1889, in which a disc of intense golden yellow dominates the horizon, ascribing a strong optimistic significance to the golden colour of the sun. He experimented endlessly with the colour of combinations. Writing to Emile Bernard, his detail, his paint choices, "Field of ripe wheat in a yellow ochre tone with a little crimson. The chrome yellow, one sky almost to as bright as the sun itself, which is chrome yellow 1 and 2 mixed, very yellow then." In his quest for the most vital yellow of his almanac, he began to take stimulating drugs, mainly detritus derived from foxglove's leaves, and at last time of his treatment for epilepsy. He also suffered from, besides much else, acute intermittent porphyria, camphor, terpenes, and dangerous chemicals used in paints. These would augment with asbestos, a liqueur which contains tarjon, known even then to poison the nerves of the system. Some doctors believe that this very concoction brought on anoxphoria, yellow vision, who suffers to see everything as if through a yellow filter, but his passion, not his sickness, that produces great paintings. Like most romantics, he had moved away from the traditional Christianity. He had once been a Protestant preacher, and, though still inspired to believe in all-powerful deity, his canvases were not religious statements. He painted the sun stripped of the allegory or pre-personification to capture, he said, the sensation of its intensity. As Robert McGill observed, quote, "Even Turner, self-pronounced sun worshipper, swathed his god in the midst of trailing clouds of sublimity, approached it with due reverence of poetic illusion. He never quite rent the veil of the temple of Sion." But if the sun was Van Gogh's the source of life, he was no mere idolator. He caught the threat of its great burning mass, the pitiless of the universe, the effervescence of existence. In letters to his brother Theo, Van Gogh explains that he is trying to accomplish, quote, his easel anchored with iron pegs against the mistral winds, quote, I'm struggling with the canvas begun some days before my interposition, a reaper. A study is all yellow, terribly thickly painted, but the subject was a fine and simple, for I see in this reaper a vague figure frightening like the devil in the midst of the heat to get to the end of his task. I see him in the image of death, in the sense that humanity might be weak, he is reaping. So it is, if you like, the opposite of a sower I tried to do before. But there's nothing sad about this death. It goes its way in the broad daylight, with the sun flooding everything with the light of pure gold. Quote, end of quote. Then, quote, there's the reaper. It's finished. I think it will be one of those you keep at home. It is an image of death, as the great book of nature speaks it. But well, I have thought that it is almost smiling. I feel queer that I saw it like this from between the iron bars of a cell. Quote. So there's a footnote. There is surprisingly appropriate passage of Aristotle's Plato Poetics linking the sowing with the sun. Quote, to cast forth the seed corn is called sowing, but to cast forth its flame is said of the sun has no special name. This nameless act, however, stands in just as the same relation to its object, sunlight, as sowing the seed of corn. Hence the expression in the poet, sowing around a God-created flame. Van Gogh was an omniscient reader of the classics, but seems not to have come across this observation. I just find it's rather strange, because I think corn came from the Americas, so I don't know what Aristotle's doing with corn. Because we know of his bouts of derangements and his confinements in the sanatorium, where the scientific treatment for his illness was to leave him in a soaking in a bath tub for hours at a time, it was easy to forget that his letters, he was a compulsive letter writer, his collected letters taking up more than 1,500 pages. Van Gogh sometimes comes across as the best and most lucid of all correspondents. Humorous, endlessly curious, sympathetic, wise without literature as well as painting. Quote, there is no writer, in my opinion, who is so much a painter and a black and white artist as Dickens. His figures are resurrections. Indeed, about all the arts, he was wonderfully sane on the page. His letters are almost unbearably moving, and more so because of the serenity of his writing. His last years saw him paint some of his greatest works. In such an outburst of creativity, he seems to know this time is short. Then, on one high summer day, 29th of July, 1890, the sun's blaze on the cornfield near Adverse finally consumed his will to live. After he shot himself, a note was found stuffed inside his shirt. The truth is, we can only make our pictures speak. Well, my own work, I am risking my life for it, and my reason for half flounder because of it. That's all right, it sounds a bit crazy to me. Many works of the 20th century art is centred on the sun. George Renoir's Crucifixion, in which the sun stands in the blood of Calvary. Paul Key's Leaf from the Book of the Towns and Ad Magrin, Max Ernst's Dahlia Sons, Paul's Nash engaged painting of the Western Front of 1918. We are making a new world. Several paintings by both Wellesley Kanzi and the Australian Impressionist Lloyd Rees, 1895 to 1988. Graham Sutherland's Sunrise Between the Hedges and Joan Maitre's People and the Dog in the Sunlight, to cite just a few. But one artist actually advanced our understanding of what paintings could achieve with the help of the sun. Henri Matisse, I love him, who died in 1984. His childhood was spent under a cool light of Normandy, and only when he moved to Nice in 1917 did the colour truly erupt from his work. Yet those first years shaped him. The whole story of his artistic development resides in that overcast beginning, in how the luminous subtlety of his originally limited brown-grey northern palette or was transformed in his years in the sun into a radical new way of depicting light. Matisse and Van Gogh were not the first painters from the north to experience the epiphany once translated into the vivid south. Delacroix had Richard's vision 80 years before, beneath the intense heavens of Morocco. But Matisse was arguably the most transformed by the experience. Writing about his move to the south of France, he mused, quote, "What may be what made me stay was the great coloured reflections of January, the luminosity of the days." Now, January is winter for them. Though this is more than a matter of intensified sunlight, there is a real cultural split based on solar proximities. The history of the agriculture, for instance, distinguishes between wine and beer. The former is further south and integrates place and work. In the latter, a given beer does not stem from a unique source of flavour, but its chemically uniform product. These facts mark out the cultures. Beyond a certain distance from the equator, one finds almost anything but a grape used for alcohol. Japan, for example, is far too north to produce decent wine. Sake is a beer. And a whole ecology of malt, junipers, potatoes, as in vodka, radically contrasting with that of the lands of wine. When Matisse moved to the south, he was uniting his northern culture to one almost completely foreign to him. His response brought colour to the painting in a way never achieved before. Even to middle age, he was constantly discovering new modes. A letter to his daughter Marguerite, written in 1925, when he was already 55, describes her response to his latest paintings, quote, "The subtlety and tone of the new canvases and harmonies of mauves and pinks is extraordinary. It's the light sliding over the caressing objects that constantly astonishes you." At the beginning of 1930, he travelled to Tahiti and other Pacific islands where he would, quote, "find dawn and darkness unlike anything he had seen before." Visiting the atoll of Fakavara, he went snorkeling and discovered, quote, that underwater light in which is like a second sky. In his new world, seen through goggles, he experimented with focus, depth and angles, starting down a green floor of lagoon, looking up at the watery ceiling, opaque and wavy medieval glass, and plunging repeatedly between the two, schooling his retina to compare the different luminosities. Back in France, his paintings became increasingly abstract. He canvases multiplying and dividing light, making it glimmer and glow compositions that reduce the mineral elements into strips, swathes and swashes, broad bands and tilted panes in pure colour. Pierre Bonnard, to whom he lent some of his paintings, staring in Matisse's studio, starting in Matisse's studio, that he expanses of flat, unreflected colour, complained wonderingly, quote, "How can you just put them down like that and make them stick?" But he did. Sometimes even Matisse himself needed time to absorb the implications of what he was doing. Quote, this is a painting. "Interior of Bars of Sunlight, 1942, expunges his model almost completely, leaving her as a young woman shaped space in a bare canvas in an otherwise geometrical arrangement of coloured bars and rectangles." He kept this apparently unfinished work by him, starting from time to time, pondering a problem, finally signing off in 1945. "The painting is a time capsule," glosses Hilary Sperling, his greatest biographer, "whose content would not make sense only long afterwards the light of optical." I really like some of his paintings. "Experiments conducted by generations of abstract artists who had not yet emerged." Matisse wrote a note to any future owners of the painting, urging them not to colour the unpainted figure in the armchair that the bottom right of the canvas. "The figure's just as it is, has its own colour, the colour I wanted, projected by the optical effect caused by the combination of all the other colours. Like Turner before him, who had etched out rainbows in the Kilkern Castle, Scotland, with a rainbow in 1802, and Christen Castle with a rainbow in 1882, 1818, by rubbing away pigments and letting the bare canvas conjure up their searing luminosity, Matisse knew that white is often the sun's most vibrant shade. And that is Matisse. He does have blank pieces of back canvas. I sort of like that. It's sort of a bit strange nowadays. There's a footnote. The Danish chancellor and this artist, Otto Ellison, who born 67, filled the turbine hall of the Tate Modern for 6 months in 2003-04 with his installation, The Weather Project, a 18,000 watt bank of street light bulbs behind translucent semicircular screen produced an unearthly light while generators wafted plumes of smoke. The huge ceiling mirror doubled the exhibit's apparent size, casting a reflection on the viewers below, but also suggested a huge circular sun. Ellison has an ingenious take on the white walls of the art gallery. Chalk is white, and chalk is used as a disinfectant, so early modernists decided on white walls, a symbolism of purification. But if chalk had been yellow, maybe our galleries would have been yellow today, and we would interpret yellow as a neutral colour. Or weirdos. It's interesting that Papua New Guinea, which is also a restaurant, has a different interpretation of yellow. His oculist in Nice, who had treated Monet, explained that his eyes could not synthesize pigment fast enough to keep up with the speed and intensity of Matisse's response to colour. The artist's last pictures, 30 views of his studio at Venice, just outside Nice, produced light and colour with a vitality so intense as to seem almost independent of physical origin. In 1991, when I was in book publishing, I asked Hilary Spurring to write a biography of Matisse. The resulting two transformative volumes would consume her efforts for more than 15 years. In May 2003, Hilary invited me to New York opening of the Matisse-Picasso exhibition. She was an ideal guide, pointing out here a Picasso woodland scene and there the same theme of Matisse, the great blocks of black and massed form of a tree somehow drawing one's eyes even more surely to the shafts of light illuminating the forest floor. It was the same with Matisse's interior blocks of furniture, table, chair, bed, slash on the back representing the curtain rod, expressing how sunlight lit up a room. Then she told me a story. At the end of December 1917, Matisse, just a week shy of 48, had moved to Nice carrying a little more than a suitcase and his paints and a violin, leaving his wife and three children behind in Paris. He knew that Pierre-Auguste Renoir lived a few miles up the coast at Cagnes, and in his first week in the town resolved to pay the master a visit. But as he approached Renoir's house, a roll of canvas under his arm, he found himself walking up and down the street trying to summon up his courage. In the end, he tossed a coin, and it came down in favour of knocking on the great man's door. Once inside, he found Renoir hardly pleased to be interrupted. His host was in his late 70s, widows, and so wasted that he had to be carried from his bed to his studio in a special chair. He lived to paint, but here he was, frail, gaunt, and crippled by arthritis, so he could not hold a paintbrush. And every day a padded handle had to be wedged between his right thumb and his four fingers. The dying artist was not pleased to be forced into conversation with the vigorous rival at the height of his powers. Nevertheless, the two talked, and after a while, Matisse spread out his paintings for inspection. The older man stomped on the canvas, stomped from canvas to canvas and muttering to himself, then looked up and said, I knew from the way you were carrying on that you were no good and had no talent. Matisse stood aghast. Then Renoir motioned to a couple of canvases lying side by side, the very same forest scene and apartment interior that would be displayed so many years later in the New York expedition. Until I saw these, he added, you used black to capture the quality of light. I could never manage that. You're the real thing. Okay, well, that's a bit of a thing. Exactly 20 years after Matisse, Cardinal moved south in 1917, a major British artist was born in the northern industrial city of Bradford and made a similar journey. He had painted a century earlier. he had painted a century earlier. David Hockney might also have moved to the south of France, but instead migrated to Los Angeles in 1964, transforming his art and his reputation. Quote, "I was brought up in the Gothic gloom," he explained in a 1993 interview with conducted in his house at Malibu, under the drenching California light. "All the buildings are absolutely dark and it rains practically every other day. I'm a bit like Van Gogh. He thought there was more joy in the sun, and I tend to think that as well." Sun, part of Hockney's 73 weather series, is one of his most celebrated paintings. It shows a potted plant on a windowsill bathed in the colour of waking light. His hair dried, its signature blonde, and dressed in golden cuffed corduroys, a yellow cardigan and shirt and olive-coloured knit tie with pink polka dots. He explained all this while walking through his bedroom, which he had painted green and pink after Matisse's drawing. Van Gogh, he added, is one of the few artists who used yellow very well. Before leaving for the West Coast, Hockney had been at the forefront of British pop art, the term serving the first being first used by Lawrence Alloway in 1958 in the issue of Architectural Digest. The movement sprang from a rebellion against the abstract expressionism, which pop artists thought pretentious and over-intense. In California, Hockney came known for its dictation of a waterhole like swimming pools, typically lush Los Angeles canyons, and beautiful young men. He also designed the sets for several operas, from Gilda Bourne to the Metropolitan in New York. Poignant as for the last 30 years, he struggled with his hereditary deafness, but like Scribbin and Sir Arthur Bliss, he is able to synthesize, in his case, perceiving music visually, then translating it into cascades of colour. His deafness, he says, has afforded him compensations, challenging the way in which he perceives space and giving him a sharper sense of light and shade. In the late 90s, in order to look after his ailing mother, Hockney bought a house in an old seaside resort in Bridlington, close to where he spent his childhood. Quote, "East Yorkshire's answer to Malibu," as his journalist who visited him for The Observer describes the town. Just before the interview, Hockney had been lying in his bed trying to capture the sun as it rose over the bay outside his window by using an iPhone application called Brushes with his thumb. When he finished drawings, he told The Observer, he emails them to 20 or so of his friends. On good days, each recipient might receive half a dozen original works as well as before breakfast. Visitors to his house routinely find themselves woken up before dawn to join him in looking the way the first light falls on particular cups, an obsession of his recent work. Hockney has been invited to fill the entire gallery of the Royal Academy during the Olympic year of 2012, and is playing a very big sunrise for the show. Quote, "I'm well aware that most pictures of sunrises are cliches, but I'm also aware that sunrise is never cliche in nature. So that's the challenge." Now, 73, he is still energetically seeking out inspiration. And some months ago, he travelled up to far up to Norway, near Tromsø, which is right up the top, where it never got dark. There's a place where you can watch the sun at midnight, and that's like the edge of the world. He also went to see Edvard Munch's sunrise at Oslo University, and was fascinated by the techniques Munch employed. He's got lines in that cameras could never see, but we could, and of course, in Oslo, in June, Munch could look at the sun for a lot longer than Van Gogh in Arles. I suppose that's interesting. Like many other artists before, Hockney has long been fascinated by the process of vision. He's led his to an interest in photography, so much so that for a while he stopped painting altogether. There is something pleasingly apt in seeing the artists whose works are so light suffused turn to a medium that actually means writing with light. Hockney's idol and Matisse's long-time friend and great rival, Picasso, did just that one day in 1949, drawing fingers in the air with a torch truly remarkable but ephemeral works of art that he could be captured only in slow exposure film. It's predominantly during Hockney's lifetime, of course, the two art forms of photography and film have established themselves, each offering the artist new ways to express the sun's power. Those seeking to investigate the optical effects of the sun now have another set of tools at their disposals. There's a picture of Picasso drawing with the light in the sky. Isn't that beautiful? Ah, oh, that's just... Ah. Oh. Gee, that's a beautiful, beautiful picture by Picasso. I have to remember. Thanks a lot. And that's the end of this page. And we're up to page 445. So there's another 200 pages easily left. Less than 200 pages. It's 150 pages. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.